I hope you guys are all doing well and having a great day. We're going to continue our discussion as to how molecules are made. And we'll talk about, first of all, how to name them so that we know what's going on. And we'll look a little bit then more about the kind of things that make them happen. And so on Monday, we ended up talking here real briefly about what an ion is. And in like this week's problem set and this week's quiz, really everything is about neutrality. Now remember, a proton is positive and an electron is negative. So if you have one proton and one electron, they cancel each other out and everything's neutral. And for what we're doing in problem set two, that's kind of the name of the game. But starting with the lab this week and the stuff from here on in, a lot of times the protons and electrons will not be the same. Metals, like sodium here, love to give up electrons usually, and usually the nonmetals, like chlorine, will take them. So in this particular example, a sodium atom and a chlorine atom are coming together. How do we tell how many protons are in sodium? Periodic table, that's right, exactly. Most of the time answering something on the periodic table is right. Yeah, you look at the atomic number, and for sodium that's number 11, that's why sodium has 11 protons. And a neutral atom of sodium would also have 11 electrons. Now likewise, chlorine is number 17 on the periodic table, so that means it has 17 protons, and a neutral chlorine would have 17 electrons. Now, like we're going to see in this section, what happens when sodium and chlorine come together is sodium likes to donate an electron, if you will, to the chlorine. So if sodium is donating an electron, it went from having 11 electrons to only 10 electrons. And that extra electron, you can't just shove it under a rug or something, it goes to chlorine. It goes from 17 electrons to 18 electrons. Now, one way to think about neutrality is to add up all the positive charges and all the negative charges and see if there's anything left over. So in the case of the sodium atom and the chlorine atom, it's like 11 times plus 1, add that to 11 times minus 1, that goes to 0. So the sodium atom is truly neutral, equal protons and electrons. And the same down here for the chlorine atom, 17 times plus 1, plus 17 times negative 1, that would also go to 0. But the minute that sodium has lost an electron, you can see now how it's like 11 times plus 1 plus 10 times negative 1. Whoa, all of a sudden you're missing an electron. Sodium becomes a positive ion. And in science, we use this term cation a lot to describe it. A cation is nothing more than an ion with a positive charge. The electron that goes to the chlorine now gives the chlorine ion a negative charge. It's like positive 17 minus 18. There's a leftover negative 1 charge. This becomes a negative ion, which we refer to as an anion. So if you hear cation and anion, they're just fancy types of names for ions. Cations are positive ions, and anions are negative ions. And these interactions are really strong. Ionic bonds are some of the strongest bonds known in chemistry, which is kind of cool. They do make really cool structures, which we'll talk about more in Chem 222. But for right now, I'm hoping you're seeing that between a sodium and a chlorine, the sodium gives up an electron and becomes positive, and that chlorine takes that electron and ends up becoming negative. Okay. Very, very silly, but if these terms are new to you and you're not used to cations, it is an important thing to remember. So you'll be thinking, oh, is cation the positive one or anion the positive one? Well, you can, if you want, remember that cats have paws, so cations are positive. Yeah, right. There's lots of chemistry cat memes on the internet. they're kind of funny anyway, if that works for you, cool. I don't have a cool expression for anions and stuff, so sorry. But if you remember that cations are positive, keep my thing.
When am I... Magnesium atom loses 2 electrons. It becomes a cation. Okay, not quite sure why that was found in there, but that's all right. This is an example of a magnesium ion. All right, now magnesium, like sodium, these are all metals. And as we're going to see in a little while, the magnesium likes to lose two electrons. So it forms a magnesium 2 plus cation, all right? It's got two less electrons than it was. And please realize that magnesium here has lost electrons and become more positive. And this is kind of counterintuitive from the economics world. You would gain money to become more positive. You'd lose money to become more negative. Chemistry is kind of reversed on that. So just realize you lose electrons to become positive. You gain electrons to become negative. Don't use the economic sense, I guess, with chemistry.
Fluorine becomes an anion when it gains one electron.
Cool. So this is a fluorine anion. It's a negative ion. And we're going to see that fluorine prefers to gain one electron to become F negative 1. And again, that means it has more electrons than protons. In this case, there are 10 electrons for every 9 protons. Remember, if you change the number of protons in either of these cases, you would change the actual atom itself. So if you take away a proton from fluorine, it would become oxygen. And if you gained a proton in terms of fluorine, it would become neon, this kind of stuff. So keeping that number the same is important. But the electrons, oh yeah, we're going to mess with those big time. So, there are three types of metal groupings where we always know what they prefer, all right? Everybody in here, if you eat pizza, probably has their favorite kind of pizza, all right? And you can think for yourself what it is. But there's preferences, all right? And some metals have a strong preference for certain types of metal, or certain types of charges. If you have a metal from group 1A, group 2A, or what I'll call the stairs on the next slide, you can always predict what their charge is going to be. Sodium is in group 1A. So if you look on the periodic table, the groups go top to bottom. Sodium is an example of a group 1A. And all of the group 1A metals have a predictable charge. They all like to equal a charge equal to their group number. So sodium in group 1A loves to be positive 1. Underneath sodium is potassium, another group 1A metal. It also likes to be plus 1. And lithium above sodium also really digs being positive 1. Now magnesium next door in group 2A prefers to be positive 2. And you'll almost always find magnesium as positive 2, just like calcium and strontium and barium and the different things. Aluminum and silver are part of the stairs, and it's easier for me just to show you a picture of that here in a second, so bear with me, but they have predictable charges too. All the other metals on the periodic table really don't have a preference for a certain type of pizza. So if you go to the pizza store, they're like, hey man, I really want a veggie pizza. Yeah, fine, whatever. Oh man, I really want a taco pizza. Okay, fine, that's cool. They're really flexible, right? And this is kind of a weird analogy here, but it really works. So iron is an example. Like, it's like, oh yeah, cool, I'll be plus 2. Oh yeah, no problem, I'll be plus 3. They have variable charges associated with them. And if you were to ask me as a chemist, like, what is the most likely charge of iron, I can tell you probabilities and stuff, but honestly, I don't know. Every iron is going to be a little bit different. And that also goes for vanadium, and it goes for chromium, and it goes for uranium in the lanthanides and actinides. All the metals that aren't 1A, 2A, and these stairs, no one really knows what they're going to be unless you study them. So there's certain types of metals, we always know their charge, and there's certain types of metals, you have to know something else about it to know what they're going to be. Now, this stairs is kind of an interesting concept.
Prof that off a little bit, prof that on. If you've come from a class where you talked about ferrous and ferric instead of iron 2 and iron 3, you will not use that in my class. I really dislike this old school kind of ferrous, ferric, cupric, cuprous kind of thing. So if you're used to that, just realize I will not be into that. And the reason is if a person doesn't know about ferrous and ferric, they won't know which is which. All right? And I want everybody to be able to figure it out. And everybody can figure it out if you use Roman numerals, but you won't have luck if you're using ferrous and ferric. Okay, before we do that though, let's say that we wanted to know what the probable charge is on a barium ion. All right? Now, barium has a Z atomic number of 56. So good, I see a lot of you doing it. Outstanding. Go to my periodic table, all right? And you want to find out where barium is. Barium is right here on this periodic table close to me. What group number is barium? Group 2A, that's right. And group 2A always wants to have a charge equal to their group number, which is positive 2. So barium is going to be positive 2 or 2 plus, you can write it either way in my class, all the time for our considerations. Metals will like never be negative in our class. Group 1 is positive 1. This would be a diatomic barium. Barium does not have no fear of ice clear brew. So barium here would be a positive 2 charge. When chemists die, you bury it. Okay, sorry. Keep my day job. it's a Friday yet. Anyway, the stairs is kind of a thing. I almost just have to show you a cheesy graphic here to kind of get up to. If you look on the periodic table, number aluminum is 13, and under it is gallium 31, and under that is indium. And to the left, you have zinc and cadmium, and to the left of cadmium, you have silver. So with a little bit of imagination, you can imagine that these are like stairs. This is the first step, the second step, and the third step. The stairs are also a set of metals where we know their preference for pizza we know what their charge is all the time. All these three metals right here, always plus 3. Aluminum's always plus 3, gallium's always plus 3, indium's always plus 3. And right next to it, zinc and cadmium, those are always positive 2. And little silver, which we used in silver nitrate, the stuff that turns your skin brown if you don't wash it off, that is always plus 1. So in addition to the groups 1A and 2A metals, we know these stairs all the time. Positive 1, positive 2, positive 3. So you don't need to use those Roman numerals and stuff associated with these, because the quote-unquote hip chemist knows aluminum is always positive 3, silver is always positive 1, etc., etc. Now, the nonmetals like to take their group number and subtract 8. And again, this is a little note more to myself than anything. If you're using the American version of the periodic table, group number minus 8. So on the American version, fluorine, chlorine, bromine, and iodine, they're all group 7. So 7, the group number minus 8, notice how all of these prefer to be negative 1. And there's no exceptions. Now, if you're using the international version of the periodic table, which webelements.com is one of them, you can do this too. It's just group number minus 18. So these over here are group 17 on that periodic table, 17 minus 18, etc. But anyway, notice here how there's predictable charges once again. Oxide, negative 2. Sulfide, negative 2. Selenide, which would be right there, also in group 6A, 6 minus 8 would also be negative 2. Nitride in group 5, 5 minus 8, negative 3 is what nitride will be. Phosphide would be right under that. Phosphide would also be negative 3. So again, there's predictable charges when it comes to the nonmetals. It's group number minus 8 in the way it is. And the number of electrons added is what these charges equal to. So we saw that chlorine loves to add one electron to become negative. Notice here too that I've added an IDE to the ending.
And in chemistry, it's really important to know where the electrons are. So chlorine becomes chloride. That's a hint to tell chemists then that, aha, chloride is the negative part, and the other part would be the positive piece. Any questions? So when we start putting these together, all right, you'll be able to tell then, like, how many negative charges these would have, or how many positive charges the metals will have if you have 1A, 2A, and the stairs. The other ones, we'll talk about ways to get their names too and stuff, so. So let's say that we had a phosphide ion. Now, phosphide comes from phosphorus, all right? When you change the name, it becomes an IDE. Phosphorus has an atomic number Z of 15, which means 15 protons and 15 electrons. But really what we want to know here is what's the charge on a phosphorus ion. What group number is on this American version of periodic table is phosphorus in?
Five.
That's right. Yep, so you go 5 minus 8, it's going to be a -3, a charge. So phosphide is -3 when you figure it out. Group number 5 minus 8, -3. If you do have an international version of the periodic table, which is cool, it would be 15 minus 18, same idea. But again, it's kind of helpful for us to do it the other way. Questions?
In 103, we were taught that the way you find the charges for basically, you know, 4A, 5A, 6A is you just take 8 minus because all of those elements want to get 8 electrons because that makes their outer shell full.
Totally. 8 minus the group number just gives you a positive number. So I wrote it the other way to explicitly show you get negative. Your way totally works. Yeah, that's right. There's more than one way to do a lot of these things, and that way is fantastic. Okay, so if you look at all of the different pieces and stuff like that, here's kind of a summary of the ionic charges. And again, ionic charges we're going to see is what happens when basically metals and nonmetals, or cations and anions, come together. So 1A, 2A, and the stairs, those are what we call fixed charge metals. And fixed charge just means we know what they like to do, all right? They always go into the pizza place and they order the same type of pizza. I must be hungry. Anyway, their charge is always positive. The magnitude, more or less equal to the group number. In 1A and 2A, it's definitely the group number. Some of the stairs you can see are a little strange, but you can follow that 3-2-1 pattern to see like what they are. So we always know that silver is +1, and we always know that zinc is +2. The nonmetals, 5, 6, and 7A, those charges are always negative, and you can take group number -8, but it's totally fine to go 8 minus the group number, not a problem. The other metals, though, these are the ones, they don't really have a preference for one type of pizza. So they'll go in and say, yeah, okay, I'll do taco this day, and next day you'll do something else, all right? So we have to kind of know more about what kind of environment they're in to use it. But if we do know the charge, a Roman number is what we represent to talk about it. So a chromium +2, you would write chromium Roman numeral 2 next to the name. That would tell the chemist which one is which.
So all the other metals are going to be positive?
All the metals are positive for our Chem 220 class. That's right. There are some times where metals can be negative, but that's just like talking about Kelvin's less than 0. I get too excited. For most 99.999% of the time, metals are positive.
So.
We're not doing any calculations here, Blake. We're just talking about it and stuff. So. Yeah, don't worry. Anyway, all right, prop that back on. You guys are both distracting me, which is easy to do, obviously. Questions? Now, Mother Nature has given us little treasures here of things called polyatomic ions. Now, poly means many, many atomed ions. What these are, and what basically, not all of these on here, but a lot of them, a polyatomic ion is when you have many atoms that stick together and they have an overall negative, occasionally positive charge. So as an example of that, and the one I'll talk about this week in lab, nitrate is a nitrogen and three oxygens. So four atoms coming together, and they have an overall negative one charge. Nitrate, like a lot of the polyatomic ions, are really, really common and also very, very stable. So they do pop up a lot. Polyatomic ions are something that us in this class and future chemistry classes are going to run into a lot. And I hate to use what I call the M word, but we're going to have to memorize these little guys because they do pop up a lot. So what I told some people yesterday in lab, and I'll tell the rest of you today or tomorrow in lab, if you have flashcards, all right, make flashcards of the polyatomic ions. So like, for example, for nitrate, on one side you could have NO3-1, and the other side you could have nitrate. And if you're waiting at the vet for your dog to come out, start looking through the flashcards, all right? You are on the bus and you're waiting to get to your stop, do some flashcards, all right? The more familiar you are with them, the better. There are some patterns and stuff we'll talk about, but these polyatomic ions do pop up a lot. So nitrate is very common. Acetate is one we'll run into a lot. Cyanide and hydroxide are ones, and I'll show you sulfate's another one, and phosphate. Some of these and stuff you may have heard of before, but we'll definitely hear a lot of them.
Do you have to memorize all the tables?
So, what I would do is, in the lab this week, there is a table of polyatomic ions. For example, like these here aren't really polyatomic ions. Look in the lab for the table I'd like you to know/memorize, okay? So the lab from this week that some of you did yesterday and will do today or tomorrow, that would be a good list and stuff to start learning/memorizing. This is a better list of polyatomics. There's actually thousands of these little guys, but a lot of them are pretty irregular. You don't see them that often. So I'm trying to get you to know just the ones that are more common, all right? There are some patterns. For example, nitrate is right here. It's a nitrogen, three oxygens, and a negative one charge, like I said. A nitrite is similar in name to a nitrate. If you go nitrate to nitrite, you're losing one oxygen. Central atom is the same, the charge is the same, but there's one less oxygen. So you go from NO3-1 to NO2-1. It's a relative change. Here's sulfate right here, which is SO4-2. And if you want to go to sulfite, you take away one of the oxygens as well, SO3-2. Knowing the patterns will make the memorization less intense, and that's kind of a cool thing. So start looking for them. One polyatomic ion we run into a lot is called the ammonium polyatomic ion. Ammonia, we saw a couple slides lectures ago, was NH3. Ammonium is NH4+1. So you take an H plus and it sticks to ammonia, like we'll see. That's what makes this ammonium cation, which is kind of common. So here's a question that sometimes helps and stuff like that. Some of the names, all right, will indicate if they have oxygen or not. And what you kind of want to look for is names like sulfate and nitrate. The ATEs and ITEs are oftentimes compounds, polyatomic ions with oxygen. Oxygen is incredibly social, shall we say. So if you have these five names right here, notice that you've got ATE, ITE, ATE, ATE. Those probably have oxygen in them. The only one that doesn't have ATE or ITE here is good old cyanide. Cyanide, which is definitely a poison, CN-1. It doesn't have that ATE or ITE. There we go. Sorry about that. Good. I think I didn't hit the button. That was my fault. Not the technology. No, it was technology. No, it was me. Sorry. Thank you. Sorry. Thanks for letting me know. Cyanide does not have an ATE or an ITE suffix, so cyanide would be the non-oxygen-containing polyatomic. Now, there's one more way that will help you to figure out the polyatomic ions, And the ATE version of a polyatomic ion is considered the most common form. So sulfate, nitrate, these kind of things are more common than, for example, sulfite and nitrite. So there's a kind of a silly expression. Nick the camel brat ate icky clam for supper in Phoenix. And there's different types of expressions like this. This is just one that happens to use. And instead of talking about weird camels eating clam, which as a vegetarian kind of freaks me out, honestly. But anyway, what it actually means is it's an acronym to help you memorize some of the common polyatomics. So Nick, camel, brat, icky, clam, sup, phoenix, etc. They help you represent what the common central atom is. So Nick is nitrogen in nitrate. C is carbon in carbonate, etc., etc. But even more interesting, the number of consonants. Now, in case you haven't taken English for a while, which is okay, A, E, I, O, U are the vowels, sometimes Y. Nick has 1, 2, 3 consonants and one vowel. The consonants actually represent the number of oxygens. So Nick, 3 consonants, has 3 oxygen atoms, and the number of vowels equals the charge. So Nick would be a way to tell you that nitrate is NO3-1. And if you go through this list, you can see how this works out. All right. Y can be a vowel, but it's not in this value, by the way. So anyway, you can say he has crepes for dinner, which is chromate. Anyway, I don't know how crazy you want to get with this. It's not like I'm going to sit down and, you know, make you say, what is Nick Camel Brat? What does it stand for? All right. But it is sometimes a way to help you learn these kind of things. Some people love this. Some people never use it. And it's totally up to you. Now, when I took chemistry back in the day and I had to walk uphill both ways to school, I would just have the flashcards, right? So nitrate, NO3-1. And that worked really well for me. But some people like these kind of things better, and that's cool too. It's up to you. Just know them, because we're going to run into them a lot and stuff. So, yeah, Mackenzie.
It says brat.
Yeah?
Oh,
that's a typo. It should be a red one stuff, so yeah. Notice the charge is -1, stuff like that. So sorry about that. That's a typo. Yeah. Other questions? Polyatomic ions have a lot of relationship to real-world chemistry. Nitric acid is one of the real powerful, strong acids used in a variety of things. Acids are acids because of the H+ that's present. So when nitric acid exhausts its acid power, which is basically this H+, it becomes nitrate. So one source of nitrates is just through using acids. Now, most nitrates don't come from this. Nitrates are used in other ways too, but this is one way that nitrates come. And again, look at the similarities. You take off an H+, you end up with a negative charge on nitrate, etc. Ammonium is one of the few positive polyatomic ions that we'll look at. Most of the polyatomics are but ammonium is actually one of them that's positive. So that H+ from the nitric acid could have went to ammonia, NH3, and made ammonium, the polyatomic ion. Then there's other ones. In biology, they use a lot of phosphates for buffers. Phosphate is a polyatomic. Sulfates and sulfites are both common. Sulfites are preservatives in wines a lot of times. Acetate is a very strange polyatomic ion with lots and lots of atoms. It has 2 carbons, the black ones, 3 hydrogens, and 2 oxygens. Acetate is written in different ways. CH3CO2-1 is very common. Sometimes you'll see it as C2H3O2-1. Just realize that there's different ways to write this. Here's another 8-to-8 comparison, like we saw sulfate to sulfite, nitrate to nitrite. And again, there are patterns to this. So here's an example with chlorate. If you lose 1 oxygen, it becomes chlorite. Same central atom, and the charge stays the same. It's just the number of atoms don't. If you lose even 1 more oxygen, it becomes a hypoite ion. So in this example, it would be hypochlorite. But again, notice, negative 1 all the time, always chlorine. We're just changing the number of oxygens. Over here, we have it adding an oxygen relative to the common chlorate. It becomes a perchlorate. Oh, boy. Anyway, try and spend some time with them. Again, personally, I'm kind of into the flashcards, as you can tell, but you could do the Nick the Camel Brat and go for clam. Anyway, whatever you want to do is totally cool.
When metallic zinc is mixed with powdered sulfur and ignited, a powerful reaction takes place that produces zinc sulfide, a compound containing only sulfur and zinc.
When you form a compound, all right, a lot of energy is usually released. If you start with elemental zinc and sulfur, there's a lot of energy that happens. But at the end of the day, you have to have a neutral compound. You have to have just as many positives as you have negatives. If you don't have as many positives and negatives, then things like oxygen and water, which are very prevalent on the Earth, will come down and they'll react with your positive or negative piece to make something different. So in this section, we're going to be really concerned with having just as many positive ion charges as negative ion charges so that we end up with something neutral.
When sodium and chlorine react, the sodium transfers an electron to the chlorine, forming oppositely charged ions. Although the compound has no net charge, its component ions of opposite charge attract each other to form ionic bonds. In turn, these ions are attracted to others, and an ionic solid called a crystal lattice is created.
The one reason why ionic compounds are so strong is that you really don't have individual green chlorines and red sodiums. It's actually a matrix. This sodium and chloride reacts, if you will, a little bit with another sodium chloride. So what red is the sodium here. It's reacting with these two chlorines, just like this one is reacting with these two. But it's three-dimensional. It goes beyond this. So like this one in the middle, there's 1, 2, 3, 4 chlorines in the plane of the molecule. There's also one above and below. Every atom has like 6 nearest neighbors. So it's a very strong arrangement of atoms. And ionic compounds are usually really hard to melt, all right, which means they need a lot of energy and stuff. Very, very strong. The other kind of compounds we're going to look at here in a little bit, they don't have this kind of three-dimensional network, so it's easier to break them up and make them react. This is ammonium chloride. Ammonium is the polyatomic NH4 plus 1. But again, you can see it's like alternating ammonium chloride, ammonium chloride. And it's all directions, all right? It's like in three dimensions. So these things can be really, really tough. All right, geology has a lot of ionic compounds in it because in the Earth, you need things that are pretty intense and stuff. So you're going to end up with these really cool three-dimensional lattices, which are take more energy to break up and stuff. So if you're going to make like calcium fluoride, you need to have equal numbers of positives and negatives. Now calcium is in group 2A, so it's always going to have a positive 2 charge on it. And fluorine in group 7, fluorine like 7 minus 8 or a negative 1 charge. So if you're going to add a calcium and fluoride together, you have to have 2 negative 1 fluorides to balance the calcium, all right? If you had just 1 calcium and 1 fluoride, you would still have a positive 1 charge. It's like positive 2 minus 1, you'd still have a positive 1 charge. So you'll need to have 2 fluorides for every calcium. The compound that's formed is CaF2. The subscript on the right-hand side represents the number of atoms. This is just saying we have 2 fluorides for every calcium. And the name of this would be just calcium fluoride.
By the way, that's the one that's good for your teeth, not the sodium fluoride they put in toothpaste.
That sounds right. That sounds right, yeah. That's kind of cool to know. Here's another example. This one isn't probably as exciting as that one, actually. That was kind of a cool application. Magnesium is in the same family as calcium, so it also likes to have positive 2. And again, anything in group 2A, which is calcium, magnesium, barium, strontium, they all like to be positive 2.
But if you're going to combine it with a polyatomic ion like nitrate, it's no problem. This whole thing is negative 1. And so just like up here with fluoride, you're going to need to have two nitrates for every magnesium. So notice how I've written this. It's Mg parentheses NO3 parentheses 2. And this parentheses 2 just means we have two nitrates for every magnesium. We wouldn't write it MgN2O6. There's reasons for that. We'll see as we go through the course. And of course, if you don't have the parentheses, you'd have MgNO32, 32 oxygens for one nitrogen. So we want to try and put the polyatomics in parentheses if there's more than one of them. And again, this would just be magnesium nitrate. Now, iron is one of the ones that doesn't have a fixed charge. So if we wanted to combine this version of iron, which is a positive 2 charge, with phosphate, and phosphate is a polyatomic ion, it's PO4, this thing has a negative 3 charge. If you want to have a neutral compound that comes between these, you need to have just as much negative as you have positive. So one thing we'll talk about in lab this week, or we did talk about in lab this week if you had lab yesterday, a common denominator is a nice way to figure out how many you've got. What is a common denominator between 3 and 2?
6.
6, that's right. So if you take that common denominator and you divide it by the charge on your ion, 6 divided by 2 means that we need 3 irons. And 6 divided by 3 means that we need 2 phosphates. That's a really nice way to figure out that the formula here of this iron phosphate compound is Fe3PO4 parentheses 2. The problem with things like iron, though, that if I said, Barbara, oh man, we need some iron phosphate, all right? She would go back to our stock room and she would probably see Fe3PO42, but she would probably also see FePO4. Now, there's a big difference sometimes in chemistry. One extra atom, you know, one baby less. We talked about that on Monday, I think it was. But anyway, it makes a big difference, your ratio of elements. So Barbara and I need a way to talk to each other about which version of quote-unquote iron phosphate I want. This particular version is a positive 2 iron. We would call this iron 2 phosphate. The Roman numeral reflects the charge on the metal itself, all right? Iron 2. FePO4, one iron for every one phosphate. Phosphate's always negative 3. That means this is a positive 3 iron. So this one would be iron, Roman numeral 3 phosphate. Now Barbara and I can communicate about which iron phosphate, quote unquote, we want, and we'll make sure we get the right chemical. Questions.
The reaction of sodium and chlorine is a vigorous one. We use sand to protect the flask from excessive heat. Then, we fill the flask with chlorine gas. Next, we add sodium, and then a few drops of water to activate the reaction. The reaction produces sodium chloride. When sodium and chlorine react, the sodium transfers an electron to the chlorine, forming oppositely charged ions. Although the compound has no net charge, its component ions of opposite charge attract each other to form ionic bonds. In turn, these ions are attracted to others, and an ionic solid called a crystal lattice is created.
Ionic compounds are so strong because they have what are called electrostatic forces acting inside them. And electrostatic is just a fancy way to say there's going to be some kind of positives and negatives. When you take the raw elements, like up here, and by the way, Barbara had a really good observation, chlorine is heavier than air. That's why it kind of stays in the flask. But anyway, a lot of energy is released because there's a lot of things. The electrostatic forces are like an energy savings, if you will, that makes it. And again, it's these wild three-dimensional lattices that form. So it's not just like one sodium to one chlorine. It's like one sodium for six chlorines and one chlorine for six sodiums, vice versa. Very, very strong.
A crystal of potassium bromide has a distinctive shape with perpendicular edges. This shape directly reflects the arrangement of the ions in the crystal lattice. The compound is composed of alternating potassium ions and bromide ions.
Sometimes you can see in our real world the actual atomic structure, how it plays out. This doesn't happen a lot, but on the atomic level you can tell very, very rigid, very rectangular, all right? And here that's what we see as well. If you make a perfect crystal of this potassium bromide, you can actually see the structure, which is kind of cool. Now, a guy named Coulomb created a law, which is used a lot in physics, to describe the strength of these ionic interactions. So if you want to know exactly how strong these forces are, you can actually use Coulomb's to calculate these kind of things. In Chem 221 through Chem 225, we won't actually calculate things using Coulomb's law, but we'll talk about how we can use Coulomb's law to describe if one type of bond is stronger than the other. In physics, this is what you'll see, or something like this, for Coulomb's law. There's a force, which is, if you will, the attraction between the positives and negatives in our world. And then there's some kind of constant, a negative side. But what I'd like you to see is that in the top part here, it's basically the number of positive charges times the number of negative charges. And that's in the numerator, the top. And in the bottom, there's the distance between the positive and negative ions. So again, it's not that we're going to calculate things with Coulomb's law, but if we wanted to know what's going to make a strong force between positives and negatives, we will look at two things. We'll look at the number of positive and negative charges, and that's directly proportional. We'll also look at the distance between those positives and negatives. As that value goes up, the force will go down. Now, this picture has some things that I'm going to use, but poor Barbara here, I'm going to use her as my model and stuff to show more about what's going on. Barbara, haven't seen you since yesterday. Yeah, good to see. This is like a bond, all right? One single handshake and stuff like that. Sam goes, oh, come on, guys, break it up. It wouldn't be too hard for her to break it up. But let's say, Barbara, haven't seen you since, wow, whenever I was, double handshake, so good to see you. Now it's going to be harder for Sam to break us up, all right, because we're double handshaking, man. And you can imagine if we had three hands, we could make a triple handshake, and then it would be almost impossible to get Barbara and I apart. Thank you. I'm going to use you in a second, though, so don't fully give up. That's the top part, all right? A single handshake. Barbara, of course, is positive, and I am, of course, negative. One times one, that would be like a single handshake, all right? And that's pretty strong. But if we want to boost this up, Barbara, haven't seen you forever, double handshake kind of thing, that would be like two times two, basically. So a double handshake, stronger than a single handshake. And if I was like Lieutenant Eric's on the Star Trek animated TV series, which probably none of you have seen, that's okay. If I had the third hand, keep my day job, if I had a third hand, double and a third hand with her double and three hand, oh man, that would be the strongest of all, because you'd have a three times three kind of interaction, much stronger. So that's what this means, all right? Now, down here, this first little picture is an example of what I tried to do with Barbara. Oh, wow, chloride, haven't seen you in a long time. Hi, sodium. So this is like a single handshake, sodium chloride, positive one to negative one, and it's pretty strong. This is like magnesium and oxide. Oh, oxide, haven't seen you forever. Oh, magnesium, really cool. This is like a double handshake. Now, they use bigger red arrows. It's not quite as cool, I think, as the double handshake, but it's the same idea. It's a stronger interaction. It's got a better red arrow and stuff like that. Pretty cool. Now, the other part, though, in the bottom is the distance. All right, so Barbara, I apologize again. Barbara, haven't seen you forever. Oh, whoa, someone's calling me away, so I have to start walking away. Oh man, it's getting hard. I'm not a yoga person, right? Barbara's working with me. Oh, finally, I'm like holding on. Pinkies, fingers. Oh, the force breaks. Thank you, Barbara. Sorry, this little student. That's the distance part. All right. There's gonna be some ideal distance. Oh, thank you. There's gonna be some ideal distance where it's good. But as I get farther and farther and farther away, then finally it breaks. You rock. Thank you. That's what this is trying to show too. If you have a relatively small distance, the force is gonna be strong. Gonna be pretty intense. But as this value begins to increase, Barbara and I are separating, separating, separating. As this goes up, your force will go down. So the strength of interactions between the positives and the negatives will also go higher. So again, we're not going to calculate the newtons, which is what you would do in physics for this kind of stuff. We won't do those kind of calculations, but we will talk about how positive one, negative one is not as strong as positive two, negative two, those kind of things. And we will talk about sometimes how as you get farther and farther and farther away, the force will go down. My thanks to Barbara. Any questions on this? So, yes.
Well,
she's a joke for it.
You can ask, was sodium really interested in the other element?
We'd
be like, nah.
Exactly. Make a meme. That would be so cool. Exactly. There's lots of jokes about sodium, nah, sodium, NA. Okay. Yep. I know where you're coming from. This conversation's obviously out of control. As the charge increases, the positive one goes to positive two, the negative one goes to negative two, will the force get stronger or weaker?
Stronger,
that's right. And I tried to represent that by a single handshake versus a double handshake. Harder to break up double handshakes than single handshakes, triple would be even harder. As the distance between the ions gets bigger, will the effective force get stronger or weaker?
Weaker.
Weaker, that's right. And I tried to show that by saying, oh, Barbara, I'm getting away from you, and then finally we couldn't even shake hands anymore, all right? So yeah, so as the distance goes up, the force goes down. As the charges go up, increase, the force will increase as well. Any questions? Yes. They're strongest in ionic bonds, but we're going to see that through something called electronegativity, which we'll talk about more later, we can also use these kind of ideas in covalent bonds too. It's very obvious in ionic bonds, and we can make it work in covalent. Good. Here's an example in a real world situation of this. Sodium chloride is a positive one, negative one interaction. 804 degrees Celsius is what you need to make those little solid salt crystals begin to melt. Now we're not putting water in and making a solution. We're actually turning the solid into liquid, like ice can turn into liquid water. 804 degrees, very, very high. Hard to break this three-dimensional lattice. But magnesium oxide, which has a very similar size between the atoms, by the way, the only difference here, this is a positive two, negative two handshake instead of a positive one, negative one. And look at the difference in the melting points, quite a bit higher than the other one. So having that positive two, negative two handshake, much, much stronger, much higher melting points to melt it and boiling points as well than just a positive one, negative one. Now, the other kind of compounds we're going to look at are called covalent compounds. And these are compounds that don't have true positive and negative charges. And as I said, we're going to figure out a way to use ionic bonds and talking about them, but really there's something a little bit different. Now, these kind of guys, for our purposes, are going to have nonmetals and nonmetals coming together. Maybe a metalloid, all right? Like boron is kind of a metalloid, but metalloids mean they can act as nonmetals. These are the kind of things we're going to start talking about now. When you have a nonmetal, nonmetal covalent bond compound, chemists will designate the difference between them by using Greek prefixes. And again, these Greek prefixes, which we're going to use, mono, di, tri, etc., we won't use those for metals and nonmetals. We're only going to use the Greek prefixes when nonmetals come together with nonmetals. Covalent bonds are not as strong as ionic bonds, so the Greek prefixes is just a way then to figure out what's happening.
The Greek prefixes, in case you're not familiar with them, are right here, mono through deca. A lot of these things are things you may have heard of before. We'll use mostly 1 through 6, but it is nice to know sometimes the 7 through 10s as well. And they're usually pretty easy to figure out. N2O4 is an example, there you go, of a compound that we need to name. And if we had all these different names, you can see that there are 2 nitrogens and 4 oxygens, all right? The Greek prefix for 4, sometimes people want to put in a quad, but the Greek prefix is technically a tetra. The second atom always gets the IDE ending, just like it did for the ionic bonds. But you can probably see then that this one would be dinitrogen tetraoxide. And if you hear that name, di is 2, so 2 nitrogens, tetraoxide, 4 oxygens. IDE just means that it's more than 2 electrons. Any questions? We'll do more on this in lab this week, or we did yesterday. We'll also continue this discussion on Friday. Have a great day, guys. I'll see you next week.